Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 5th of June. We're going to have a wonderful conversation this hour. Jo Sandeen is with us, and she is the author of a book on bonobos, Bonobos, Encounters in Empathy. It is the Zoological Society of Milwaukee's 2007 book, and the proceeds go to help the zoo's bonobos and to support bonobo conservation projects in Africa. She's a longtime reporter for the Milwaukee Journal. She wrote about the Milwaukee County Zoo for over four decades. She also covered the welfare beat, covered Father James Grappi's marches. She retired in 2002, was inducted into the Milwaukee Press Club's Hall of Fame. And she has found these, and she's so right about this. There's something about these creatures, and partially because they're us in so many ways. It's like 98.4% of their genetic identity is what our genetic identity is as well. So we have much to learn from them, but they also have this unusual society and the role of females and the role of empathy in their lives. As she says, watching and writing about the behavior and culture of these apes is a bit like poetry. When you pay attention to the details of their lives, you see beauty, empathy, drama, rhythm, humor, and kindness. And we're happy to have Jo with us to talk about bonobos. She'll be giving some speeches tonight. We'll tell you about them at the Harry Schwartz Bookshop in Shorewood, and then on Thursday at the Schwartz Shop in Brookfield. So remind me to talk about that, and you can have a chance to look at, to hear her talk about bonobos and look at this book that has the most extraordinary pictures. I mean, I got to confess, I got this book, and I kissed the guy on the front cover because I thought that maybe it's a she, but this is a picture. It's filled
Murph
with pictures.
Would be so glad.
Who is it?
Murph.
Oh, that's my dog's name too. Oh, I love
he's
it.
He's a contender.
Oh,
he has for new alpha male.
Oh, they're so just so extraordinary. Thank you, Jo, so much for being with us. And you know, we have a problem. Can't hear her. What's the matter here? Wait a second.
Okay.
Can
is that better? Yes.
No, talking.
Oh, of course. Murph would have been so pleased.
Yeah. There we go. Now we're fine.
Uh-huh.
The thing is about these creatures that we didn't even know they existed until what, the 1920s, Jo?
Yes. Actually, until the 1930s.
Oh, my gosh.
When someone was going through a museum collection of skulls and took a better look at the skull of what had been identified as a juvenile common chimpanzee.
Hmm.
And he looked at the entire skeleton and said, "This looks to me as though it's an entirely different animal." And by 1933, his fellow biologists had agreed, and we had a new species.
Isn't that simple?
Yes. They're still called pygmy chimpanzees. They're not really smaller. They're just shaped differently.
Mm-hmm.
Longer arms, really stronger legs, mm-hmm. because there's more upright walking. They call bonobos the gracile chimpanzees, and they are mm-hmm. quite graceful, really lovely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And how did Milwaukee get the largest, I understand, number of bonobos in captivity?
By empathy, as a matter of fact. Enterprise and
great.
Empathy.
Great.
Enterprise because Gay Reinertz, when she was still the person who, the registrar for the zoo, who keeps track of all the animals, noticed in a zoo publication that a small private zoo in the Netherlands wanted to place all its gorillas and all its bonobos in a common home to cease to minimize the upset
mm-hmm.
at such a gigantic move. And she told Gil Bosley, who was then director of the zoo, about it. And he negotiated with considerable skill because the zoo that was bidding against us was a private zoo in Saudi Arabia that had unlimited funds.
My. Yeah.
However, the clincher of the deal, the private zoo was run by a couple who were just fascinated with animals and splendidly equipped to nurture them. And they had run essentially a rescue operation for primates because, of course, the Dutch are known for shipping. And when their sailors visited African ports, they often bought cute little baby monkeys who then grew up, you know, to be gorillas and common chimpanzees and, in this case, bonobos. And they did the rescuing because, obviously, a life as a pet is not appropriate. And the sailors quickly discovered this. So Gilbosi said, we can offer you something that the Saudis perhaps will not. We can make certain that 1.5 million people, because that was the number of people then visiting the zoo every year, will know about Wassenaar, about your zoo, and about the care you gave to these animals, which we later discovered was just amazing. It, in some way, preserved their culture.
My, remarkable.
Because they were uprooted, of course, in the worst possible circumstances from their homes. They saw their mothers killed before them by poachers. But evidently they were probably about 2 years old when they were captured. And so they were old enough to remember some of that. And then they received maternal nurture when they went to this zoo. Because these wonderful people nurtured the animals and held them and sang to them and talked to them and all the things that a bonobo mother would have done.
Yeah. And then the story, which always blows me away, years and years later, and you write about this, you can just imagine it from the way you describe this, the bonobos are reunited. This couple comes back to the United States to the zoo. They recognize their former caregivers, and as you say, they leap into the air. They hugged, hooted loudly, and generally acted as though they were so full of emotion they couldn't contain themselves.
Exactly.
They remembered them
absolutely.
These years later.
Absolutely.
That's amazing.
Yes. And, of course, they were both much older.
They didn't look the same.
Yes, they didn't look the same. But what they cued into was the voices.
Yes.
And when Haneke sang a lullaby that she had used to soothe them, they just, wow, it's celebration time. It was an amazing moment.
Yeah. So the zoo gets these bonobos back in what year was it?
1986.
Yes. And they don't exactly know what to do with them. They don't know a whole lot about bonobo behavior.
Nobody did.
Yeah.
Nobody did. I mean, even the Japanese, who have been in the forest longest doing primary research and observation, hadn't published that much by that time. And so the keepers realized that they had in their care some very frightened animals and some animals who were strong enough to express their displeasure. Hey, things are not as we want them to be. This is not a good place for us. Something has to change. And they picked up on that and said, okay, what do we do? What do we do? What do we do? And so they consulted every possible source, people who were doing psychological work with chimpanzees, other breeding colonies, anybody who had done any research, and this was all before the internet, so they were, you know, doing it by letter and by telephone all over the world. And eventually they thought, okay, let's give a try to something that has worked with other primates, engaging the intellect. And so they started a program of training. And this was not a program of performance training. This was a program that would make it possible, for example, for the bonobos to participate in their medical care. So they could avoid being anesthetized for the simple things that veterinarians mm-hmm. need to do to make certain that everybody's healthy.
Mm-hmm.
So they could get the necessary immunizations they needed mm-hmm. without undue stress. And we know how important this is because one of the bonobos that came to us a little after
Brian.
Our first group died under anesthetic.
And
we have wonderful veterinarians mm-hmm. who are very sensitive to the needs of those in their care. Mm. But every once in a while, the stress is just too much.
Mm-hmm.
And so if anesthetic could be avoided, this was so much the better. And, of course, as they introduced very gradually training programs that would allow interaction between zookeepers and bonobos, they discovered something else was happening. There was beginning to be a relationship of trust.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, this always happens when we work together. It's pleasant. It's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's even delicious because, of course, food rewards are
mm-hmm.
up. And it's always voluntary.
Mm.
When I want to walk away, I walk away, and nothing bad happens to me.
Mm-hmm.
So gradually, three amazing, innovative keepers, one of whom is now the chief bonobo keeper, Barbara Bell, but her two fellow keepers, Becky Lay, who is no longer with the zoo, and Trish Kahn, who is primate supervisor now, just devised all manner of interactions that would be, first of all, very quick. Never longer than a minute. Originally, if we can keep eye contact for a minute, and also if we can convince that eye contact is not a challenge, that of course it often is
mm-hmm.
in other settings, we can work from there. And they did.
Hmm.
It was amazing.
Hmm.
Eventually, you got to a situation in which the first person to whom they showed off new babies was Barbara Bell. Here is my new baby. Would you like to put your finger very gently on her forehead? This is an amazing act of trust.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. When did you and how did you start observing them? Why were you captivated by them?
Well, they're compelling animals. Bonobos live on the grand opera or the soap opera stage, depending, on your preference. They are melodrama incarnate. One of my children has dramatic tendencies, and I have worked with many children who have had dramatic ways of expressing themselves. I have friends who are writers who have volcanic personalities, so I recognize this behavior. It looked very natural to me. And I, too, was just fascinated.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Tell us this story. So much of this is so new, too, which I find fascinating. The story of Brian, the very troubled bonobo who was brought in, why he was troubled,
Surely. And
how the zoo reached out to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist turned Brian around.
Oh, yes. The psychiatrist and some extremely dedicated zoo keepers, because they made the regimen possible.
Yes. Right.
Yes. Brian came to us in 1987. As an extremely troubled, very young bonobo. He was about 11, I believe. For some reason or another, it had been advisable or had seemed like a good idea at the time to keep him with only his father. He was not with his mother. And Bonobo babies are with their mothers almost all the time. Other bonobos give care and give affection, give all sorts of play, but they're with their mothers almost constantly. So Brian had an unusual childhood. And when he got to us, he came to us because even 11 years after our first bonobos arrived, we had established a reputation that was growing throughout the zoo world as a safe place for bonobos who didn't seem to fit in any place else. And the number of bonobos in captivity even now is extremely small. And so the breeding colony is very small, and the number of really genetically diverse members of this community is relatively small. And Brian represented a different line. And so not only was he treasured for himself, which he was, but he was potentially important to the program that continues to save the species.
Right.
So no one wanted to even consider euthanasia. But he was extremely troubled. And he did what a lot of human beings who are extremely troubled do. He mutilated himself. He couldn't sleep. He wouldn't eat. If he did eat, he threw up anything he ate. I mean, he was obviously an extremely troubled animal. And Barbara Bell tried everything that had worked to welcome other newcomers into the community, and none of it worked. So finally, she and Gay Reinerts, who is, of course, the species coordinator for the Bonobo Species Survival Plan, consulted, and Gay said, I know a psychiatrist at Medical College of Wisconsin, and he's really great. In fact, he's chairman of the psychiatry department, and besides which, he's just really a nice guy. Let's ask him if he can think of anything. So Harry Prosen entered the scene, and he was fascinated. He looks just like many of my other patients.
He looks like me.
I mean, he was, and the zookeepers, whose specialty obviously is not abnormal psychology, usually, were astonished to hear that human beings engaged in these behaviors. You mean we do this? Oh, yes, yes. And Harry would, list, oh, my goodness. And so Harry did what any good psychiatrist does. He sent for the case notes. He contacted all the people who had had any relationship with Brian and got a thoroughgoing, life history of him. And then he called a case conference of everyone who had Brian's welfare to heart, and they consulted, and he said, he needs to feel safe. This is extreme anxiety. So let's make the world utterly predictable. And, of course, they hadn't thought of this because bonobos, being very intelligent individuals, are easily bored. So what would have sent his fellow zoo residents screaming in boredom calmed Brian. Every day he ate, and he ate separately, because one of the things Brian didn't know was of the extremely elaborate etiquette system of bonobo society. If you've ever had tea at a pseudo-Victorian hotel, You have some grasp of how complicated it might be. So he had his meals alone, and he had his meals at the same time every day. And after meals came the same thing every day. And people spoke to him in the same words, in the same tone of voice. Every day. Mm-hmm. Now you can imagine this is really special care that's being fit in around an extremely busy schedule of caring for everyone else, making sure everybody else gets fed, making sure everything is clean, making sure everybody gets their shots, making sure the vet comes in at the right time, seeing who's pregnant, that kind of thing. And yet the keepers, God bless them, made it possible. And gradually, Bran began to relax. When social contacts were resumed, they introduced him to the most stable, least threatening members of the group first. He was often combined with Kitty, who, as far as we know, is the oldest bonobo in the world in captivity. She's 57. And she's blind and deaf and had seizures, but is still a contributing member of the community. Not only is she the receiver of tender care, but she also still grooms Brian when he has acted up, and the ladies who are in charge of the group have administered swift and sometimes painful discipline to him when he's overreached himself. Oh, and he realizes, oh my goodness, that wasn't such a great idea after all. Kitty still calms him down.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Joe, and we'll take them in a moment. Joe Sandine is our guest. Longtime reporter for the Milwaukee Journal and author now of Bonobos, Encounters in Empathy. She's written lots of stories for the Journal, but she did cover the Milwaukee County Zoo for a number of decades, over four decades, actually. She'll be talking about bonobos in her book this evening at the Harry Schwartz Bookshop in Shorewood at 7 o'clock tonight and Thursday, the 7th of June at 7 at Schwartz in Brookfield. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. We also need to talk about the Zoological Society of Milwaukee's bonobo conservation projects in Africa. This zoo is doing so much to save the species, and an important species they are. 800-486-8655. We'll be with you in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Feel free to join our conversation. I know that many of you know a great deal about bonobos, and probably a few of you have spent some time, more than your share of time, looking at the bonobos at the Milwaukee County Zoo. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. Joe Sandine's book is Bonobos, Encounters in Empathy, and it is the 2007 zoological book, and all the proceeds will be going for the Zoological Society.
That's right. 50% for the bonobos here. They have their own bank account. It's 0319 and species fund, and the rest to the Congo Biodiversity Project, which Gay Reinertz heads the research station at Etate, which is in the heart of the Salonga Forest. The one place on Earth that bonobos have genuine protection as well as paper protection against poachers and other unpleasant things. It's a former poacher station.
Oh, my.
So that alone tells you how much the Zoological Society has been able to accomplish there. They began by just wanting to find out how many bonobos there might be. And so they proposed a research expedition. Their first research expedition was carried out by a graduate student and a Congolese naturalist in 1997, and then civil war broke out.
Oh my!
Yes, and they saw plenty of habitat for bonobos in the Salonga, and they found many poaching stations.
Oh my goodness!
Yes, so it was a rather dire first report from the field. Then Gay went back after Etate. Etate was established as a research station while the war was still going on. And with the cooperation of Congolese, the Zoological Society was able to provide money to pay the guards, who rangers who were putting their lives on the line every day to protect their country's natural heritage and yet had not been paid in years.
Oh, my.
And then in 2001, Gay herself went after a crash course in French. What you will do when you are sufficiently motivated.
Right.
Bless her, she is. And the fact that she went before all the civil war had died down just increases her credibility enormously among the people with whom she cooperates there. We have a year-round now research station in which people are actually paid to do their jobs. They're trained to do their jobs. They are equipped with global positioning system units, which allow them to keep constant reports on the number of bonobos they see and where they see them in sectors that are cut through the jungle, and sometimes cut through the jungle several times a year because the rainforest grows back that fast. So it's a fascinating operation.
So really the zoo is doing a heck of a lot to save this species,
right? Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It's not that other people are not. It's just that this has been a major contribution. We now have the first even good guess about how many animals might still exist in the wild.
And the answer is?
The answer is there might be as many as 19,000. This does not mean 19,000 individuals have been sighted. This means that Gay and her research teams have gone fanning out through the Salonga forest in a very methodical way in sectors out from the research station, have noticed signs of bonobo habitation, appropriate foodstuffs, all the kinds of things that these fairly nomadic in the wild individuals leave behind them when they go from nesting place to nesting place. And using a very complicated formula, which I don't understand, but Gay does, they figure that perhaps as many as 19,000 could exist in Salonga Forest.
Oh, that's heartening.
Yes, it is.
Let's welcome phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Teresa is our first caller from Milwaukee. Hi, Teresa.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question. I was touched by the post of Ryan, and I was wondering if it's common practice now or in the near future to have an animal psychologist on staff. You'd think that would be pretty beneficial for many animals, but especially for the bonobos.
I'm not sure how necessary it would be. In Milwaukee, we are so fortunate because essentially there is a consulting psychiatrist whose expertise is always available to the zoo. Also, fortunately, in Milwaukee, there is a call list of, probably two dozen human medical specialists. Everything from cardiologists to pulmonary specialists to obstetricians, gynecologists to plastic surgeons who have and, of course, a magnificent dentist. Well, you know, there's dental caries in the animal world as well, right? And these individuals have made themselves available free of charge. They donate their services. And the veterinarians at the Milwaukee Public Zoo call them whenever their services are needed. And because our own veterinarians speak frequently at American Zoological and Aquarium meetings throughout the year, we have reason to believe that other zoos have adopted this practice as well. It would be lovely if we could keep everyone on staff, but that's a matter of funding, isn't it? And the zoo and the Zoological Society are doing a splendid job of that, but I'm not sure the budget quite goes to a consulting psychologist.
Thanks very much for the call. We have lines open if you'd like to join our conversation with Jo Sandeen about her book, Bonobos, Encounters in Empathy. Longtime reporter for the Milwaukee Journal, inducted in the Milwaukee Press Club's Hall of Fame in the year 2002. We've had Franz de Waal on the air a couple times talking. He loves the bonobos here. He goes over there all the time. And we spent a lot of time talking about the good in us, the violence in us. After observing bonobos for so long, can we say that they are the better angels of our nature?
They often seem like it. This does not mean that violence is unknown. For example, we were talking about the fact that forcible females set the norms, the behavioral norms for the community. When I say forcible, I mean that word, because they often use force. We talk about hooters and people who, individuals who hoot, and those who are toe biters, because if a suggestion is not taken to heart, that's the next step. If you don't get the message in one way, you'll get it in another. And so discipline is often physical, not toward the young, toward other adults, obviously. But they certainly exhibit empathy regularly toward each other, especially toward weaker members of the group. This does not mean that there aren't teases and there aren't difficult phases of bonobo life. For example, the terrible teens are sometimes really terrible. Barbara Bell calls it the brat stage of development, and sometimes it lasts a decade or more.
Oh, man.
And, yeah, it just, how can I have fun by
getting in your face.
Exactly. Right. And teasing you and making fun of you and making sure you understand how important I am. However, in contrast to that, you have this lovely, gentle Murph, for example, who's on the front of the book, who certainly went through prolonged a brat stage that we're not quite sure is over yet. Nevertheless, he has been observed carefully making certain that Kitty is able to reach the sunniest spot of the outdoor enclosure where she likes to sit, or that she is hugged and cared for when she is having seizures, because she does have seizures from time to time. Lodi, who is the alpha male of the group, relinquishing control slowly because he has some health difficulties now, and the other males sense this and are taking advantage of it. There are aggressively assertive bonobos, just as there are aggressively assertive and ambitious humans. Lodi is a wonderful example. He took care of Brian. When Lodi's own position was unchallenged, he made certain that Brian was often cared for. For example, he would wait to eat until Brian was eating, so Brian could have a social meal, which is common for bonobos.
But when you compare them with chimpanzees, I'm sure you've observed chimps.
Oh, yes.
Do you see a marked difference, Jim?
Oh, absolutely. Because there, where the males are really dominant in all situations, as far as I can tell, there are even raiding parties that go out and make war on nearby groups. Because bonobos are so few, and because we have seen them only fleetingly, except on the edge of the forest where the Japanese have lured them out by sugar cane, by putting sugar cane out. And so you don't really see a natural competition for food there because the food is there. We don't know how they handle clashes over food or the best water places in the wild, because we think, as far as we can tell, that they merely exclude those who refuse to cooperate with the group, because it's a matter of survival, obviously. The whole group has to cooperate. Whole group has to cooperate to keep the baby safe. The group has to cooperate in following the make love, not war philosophy that is dominant. And this is how they ease tensions most often. Yes, of course.
Sexually.
Yes, sexually. Sexual contact between any and all combinations of bonobos is, good morning, how are you, let's have a banana. Do you really want that extra piece of mango? Ah, let's make a baby. Let's get this out in the open. We need to talk about it. Sexual conduct of all kinds, anything that you can imagine, is a common means of interaction. It also calms upsets. It also provides opportunities for reconciliation. I mean, we've seen that in the group at the zoo. And there, they can't exclude. And we feel that perhaps there's a little bit more toe-biting going on in any confined community simply because they can't run off the offender. We can't say, get lost until you shape up, as is probably done in the wild.
We pause for a moment. We'll return. And welcome phone calls. You know, maybe this is the kind of conversation it's hard to enter, but feel free. I'll give you the number again. And if you'd like to talk about bonobos with us, we'd love to hear from you. Jo Sandeen is our guest. She's the author of Bonobos, Encounters in Empathy. And it's a lovely book. The pictures are just extraordinary. And as she says, their tale is a gripping good tale. She's going to be speaking at 7 o'clock tonight at the Harry Schwartz Bookshop in Shorewood, and Thursday, June 7th at the Schwartz store in Brookfield. The Milwaukee County Zoo has just done remarkable things to save this species. The Bonobos, Encounters in Empathy, is the Zoological Society of Milwaukee's 2007 book, and the proceeds will go to help the zoo's bonobos and to support bonobo conservation projects in Africa. 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joe Sandine is our guest, and we are talking about bonobos. Her book is Bonobos, Encounters in Empathy. Here to join us, our number is 800-486-8655. I always like to talk about animals that are as smart and maybe in some instances smarter than we are. You again and again talk about how intelligent these animals are. How do they express their intelligence, Joe?
First of all, through play. I always bring that up because brother-in-law is a computer artist, and he reminds me constantly that, of course, play is essential for all creative types. And they are very creative in their play and in inventing games with themselves and with each other. The other way they startlingly demonstrated is through understanding of our language. We have not cracked their vocal language code as yet. We understand a good many of their gestures and their interactions and the other kinds of body language, that sort of thing, communications in which they indulge. But we really don't understand their language yet, but they obviously understand ours, not only with the words that are used, for example, to invite participation in a medical routine, but also, Leanne's coming today. They recognize the name. Oh, Leanne Rothbeeler is bringing her marvelous ultrasound machine. We're going to find out. We're going to see pictures of the baby. Wow. Everybody comes around.
Amazing.
It's amazing. Or look who's here. It's Vicki Clyde. And they know, okay, fine, I'm first in line for the blood pressure cuff. Or when Barb says to another keeper, I think we'll, because she tries to mix and match whoever's getting along with whoever else, you know, she looks at the social dynamics constantly to make sure that people who are getting along are on exhibit with each other and nobody's in the playroom who's going to keep everybody else out, that sort of thing. So they often line up according to what she has suggested. And then conversely, if that's not to their preference, they refuse to line up with that, and instead, yes, you said that Lodi was going on. All right, fine, he can head the line, but no, we're not going up with him. No, Moringa and Linda will go today, and so their obvious preferences. Also, the power struggles. Oh my word, you'd swear they all read Machiavelli's The Prince. My word. The strutting around. It's amazing. The kinds of, the Lodi look. For years, he kept peace without lifting a finger, just by administering. And what looks exactly like the scolding that we may have gotten from our mothers when we stepped out of line, Moringa regularly, she's, you know, the diva who's beginning to slip a little, but she's still often the matriarch. And she regularly gives a talking to. That's obvious. Yes, and the young male is standing there.
Oh, my.
looking just as shamefaced and just as guilty as we probably looked when our mothers were giving us a talking to.
Yeah. Let's go to some phone calls. Jackie from Milwaukee. Hi.
Good morning. In the 60s, I managed a pet store. Restrictions on bringing animals in were almost non-existent at that time. And at the store, we had, over a period of a few months, three, what at that time they called woolly monkeys. Were bonobos ever called woolly? They were definitely not squirrel monkeys or anything like that. They were highly intelligent. I knew the three people that different people that I sold them to. One was a priest who had figurines that you wouldn't believe from going to Italy. He was a teacher, and that animal had been taught not to touch them. Another one was a person who had one who lived down in the inner city and bought one, and they would take them out in the parks, and they would go up into the trees, and when they called them, they would come back.
That's fascinating. No, not to my knowledge. Were they ever called woolly monkeys? Did they have tails?
Very short.
There are no tails on bonobos or chimpanzees or gorillas or orangutans. That's the definition of an ape. So,
I don't remember if they had a tail or not. Mm-hmm. I know that the people, the priest that had it, It had a diaper.
Oh my gosh!
Yes.
And it was. They were not vicious. They were very loving. They loved being held. And I, being an animal person, I held everything that was in the store. But you don't know that. That could have been the animal that they were ever called anything else.
No, not woolly monkeys. How large were they?
They looked like a very small chimpanzee.
No, bonobos are about the height of an adult chimpanzee. The proportions are different, but they're certainly that height.
Thanks very much for the call. You talked about they've cracked our language code, but we have not been able to crack theirs. Why is that? After so much careful observation of them, why is it so hard to crack it?
Well, in the first place, to crack a language code, you have to have training in linguistics. This is an extremely really complicated art form. My daughter happens to be a speech-language pathologist. She would be fascinated, did she have the time, mm-hmm. to do the kinds of observations that could pick up on the communications, mm-hmm. but that would include physical communications as well. Human language is difficult, and so are other languages. We still have not cracked the language of whales, for example, and we've been listening to them, mm-hmm. carefully much longer.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a feeling we're a long way away from there, mm-hmm. Until perhaps someone manages to do an appropriate computer program.
Yeah. Let's go to Bruce from Milwaukee. Hi, Bruce. Running short on time.
Hi. I heard a program in Cleveland at the Natural Science Museum there about a group of professors at the University of Indiana who had worked with chimpanzees to make the equivalent of Stone Age tools that men might have made or hominids might have made. Are the bonobos that same group of chimpanzees? And are you familiar with what they're doing in Indiana?
I am familiar with that. And no, bonobos are tool makers and tool users. We're not providing stones and flint napping tools here, because we do have a number of bonobos in the brat stage of development, and Yes, they would throw them.
Oh. So,
yes, and I'm not sure that the dominant males are quite strong enough to keep them very safe. But yes, that's a fascinating area of study, and bonobos do show that they also use tools. They use levers, for example. They use a number of everyday items that are in their enclosures to accomplish the kinds of things we use tools for.
Bruce, thanks very much for the call. Joe, have fun tonight. Thank you so much for being with us and for doing the book. I will treasure it. Thank you. Joe Sandeen, and the book is Bonobos, Encounters and Empathy. It has just been published. You will be talking about it tonight at 7 o'clock at the Harry Schwartz Bookstore in Shorewood, Thursday at 7 at Schwartz in Brookfield. And the proceeds for this book will help the zoo's bonobos and also support bonobo conservation projects in Africa. She's a longtime reporter for the Milwaukee Journal and retired in 2002 and at that time was inducted into the Milwaukee Press Club's Hall of Fame. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this hour and to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks, everybody, for your calls and for listening. Let's go see the bonobos. Yeah, that's what I want to do this afternoon. I'm off to see the bonobos. Thanks for listening. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.